The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Hey folks, today's show is sponsored by Howl FM. It's like Netflix for podcasts. With Howl Premium, you get exclusive access to dozens of Howl original miniseries, like Super Ego, an improvised comedy that presents profiles in self-obsession, delivered by doctors Matt Gourley, Jeremy Carter, Mark McConville, and Paul F. Tompkins. Access it all on your iPhone, your Android, or on the web for only $4.99 a month. Use the promo code MALTIN, M-A-L-T-I-N, at checkout. You get a full month for free. Why not try it? It's Howl.fm. Howl.fm, and use the promo code MALTIN. That's my name. Hey, everybody. This is MALTIN on Movies with Baron Vaughn. I'm Leonard Maltin.
And I'm the other guy, Baron Vaughn.
And we are very pleased to be joined today by one of my favorite filmmakers, John Sayles. John, welcome.
Thanks. Nice to be here.
I don't put words in Baron's mouth, but you're a favorite of both of ours, right?
Yes. Okay. Yes.
And
yes,
we have featured several of your films on the show. Passion Fish.
Yeah, Passion Fish with my close friend in it. Alfrey. I don't mean to brag. And then, of course, Brother from Another Planet.
Wonderful.
With my second best friend in it, Joe Morton.
Good people. You have had over the years a really good track record for casting.
Yeah, I've been very lucky. I've gotten a bunch of people on their way up, you know, before they were known. You know, the business has changed. We got to make Mate One with Chris Cooper as the lead, and he'd never been in a movie before.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that just doesn't happen.
Yeah.
You know, it costs some money. It was cheap, but it costs some money. And then I've gotten to – I was at one point I made a movie called Casa de los Babies, and I had four Academy Award winning actresses in it, you know. And, you know, they weren't at the height of their hotness, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, their career hotness, you know, personal hotness, they were at the height of it. It was just so great, and they had the fun of, you know, there's a lot of sports movies and army movies where guys get to work with each other. There's not that many movies about groups of women.
Mm-hmm.
So there we were in Acapulco, and all these women, you know, trading stories about directors who had bugged them and that kind of thing.
Cool. I'm going to ask you, because people may not know the story, how you came to make your first movie as writer-director. Which is Return of the Caucus 7.
Yeah, I had just started working for the movies as a screenwriter.
Mm-hmm.
I had been a novelist before that.
Right. Mm-hmm.
I had been a worker in a sausage factory before that.
Mm-hmm.
I had also done some acting in summer stock.
Mm-hmm.
And the guy, Jeffrey Nelson, who was the producer of the summer stock company, he said, well, you know, you're making some money now. He didn't know how little. He didn't know Roger Corman.
Some money.
And we know so many good actors. And so why don't we make a movie? And he knew as little about it as I did. But it seemed like that would be really fun. And I had this idea that, well, maybe I can write my way to becoming a director, the way that John Huston and other people had in the past.
Mm-hmm.
But that was like the 10-year plan. I said, well, maybe there's this other plan. You know, the Stanley Kubrick plan. You make a couple, you know, maybe obscure little movies, but when somebody says, you know, have you seen anything interesting? And they say, well, I've seen, you know, The Killing or one of his movies, and he gets a shot at a you know, a movie with a real budget. So I thought, well, that sounds like a good idea. And I looked in my bank account, and I had $30,000. And, you know, this is 1979, and when am I ever going to have $30,000 in the bank again?
Right, right.
I better spend this quickly.
Mm.
And what better thing to spend it on than working with friends and making a movie? And so it is a unusual movie even for me in that I literally sat down and said, what with my lack of experience and definite lack of money can I do well for $30,000? Okay, this is going to be a contemporary movie set in one place, set in a very short time, about people who as it turns out, like all my actor friends who aren't in the Screen Actors Guild yet, are turning 30. And there's going to be a lot of them. So I have some reason to cross cut, you know. So there's some movement because I'm not going to have the money to afford to rent a crane or, you know, do a lot of tracking shots or anything like that. And so I started thinking about what was going on with friends of mine who were turning 30 and what the public image was of them. We got a bunch of guys who had been shooting commercials in Boston to be the crew. We had a 7-person crew, and a bunch of actors that I knew from acting with them. We shot in North Conway, New Hampshire, where the summer theater I had worked in was, and there was a big old ski lodge there that we knew in the summer we could rent for very cheap, because there's no snow. And that served as the place where we put all the actors up and for all the interiors. We would just take one of the rooms. And we didn't know at the time that the place was old enough that you couldn't actually put a dolly in the middle of the floor without it falling through. So there are some moving shots in it where we had to keep the dolly in the corner of the room and put a jib arm out and swing that around because, mm-hmm. you know, it started to groan so much when we moved it toward the center. But, you know, I think the real advantage was, except for one actor who had 2 days on a movie, nobody else had ever worked on a feature. So we were all going into this alone, and nobody's feeling like, oh, somebody's going to – I'm doing this wrong. Mm-hmm. You know, that somebody knows what they're doing here. And I was able to say, look, I'm figuring this out too, but we're going to – you know, we're going to work reasonable days, and we're going to have 5 weeks to shoot this, and, you know, we're going to pitch in and do things together. And so it was an unusual case of having a really good time making a movie with no expectations. We didn't even expect it to ever get on a movie screen. We thought that maybe PBS might pick it up or something. And mm-hmm. so I actually shot it in something more like a TV ratio. Mm-hmm. And if you see the movie today, because we eventually had to blow it up from 16mm to 35mm, mm-hmm. and we do that, the aspect ratio gets much more rectangular. Mm-hmm. We had to lose information on the top or the bottom or both of the frame. And so there's some really, really ugly shots where, you know, the frame line is right under somebody's chin or mm-hmm. something like that. You know, it happens. Mm-hmm. You know, things change because we eventually got very lucky. We got into, just through somebody who knew somebody, the New Directors Festival in New York. Mm-hmm. And then a person who worked for that said, oh, you've submitted it to FilmX out in Los Angeles, which was an early film festival, very good early film festival here. And we said, well, when's the deadline? He said, in 2 days. And we shipped a printout. And what I later learned was that Paul Bartel of Eating Raoul, and who was an actor who I had met on the set of Piranha, which I had written, mm-hmm. was on the committee that year. And he was the guy behind the projector. And after about 10 minutes, he just turned the lights on and said, we want this, right? and so people actually who on the committee had to go to the movie during the festival to see the whole thing.
And then it got acquired for distribution.
It got acquired for distribution. There were about 4 or 5 independent distributors in those days. Mm-hmm. Mostly they brought in foreign movies. Mm-hmm. And we were very lucky in that it was that moment when home video was just on the horizon. And I think a lot of the places that had been calendar houses realized, oh, my God, we can't show the 400 Blows, you know, every June 4th for 2 weeks because people are going to own that movie now. Mm-hmm. And so we need to rethink this. We need some new sources of movies, and maybe we have to consider open runs like the regular theaters do, you know, if something really, really works. So I do remember there was a very small circuit at that time of movie houses that showed off Hollywood movies. Mm-hmm. There was a place called the Biograph in Chicago, which is, mm-hmm. you know, John Dillinger was shot outside the Biograph.
Oh,
I wrote Lady in Red, you know, which, mm-hmm. You know, deals with that.
Another and Roger Corman film.
Yes. Yeah. And they kept the seat where they say he was sitting without any, you know, upholstery on it. So it was just a metal, you know, frame. And, but it was the only art theater mm-hmm. in Chicago. Mm-hmm. And so we were in a holding pattern over Chicago for 3 or 4 weeks because My Brilliant Career was doing so well. Mm-hmm. And then we got in there and did well, and somebody else was in a holding pattern mm-hmm. waiting to play Chicago. Mm-hmm. It got better as the 80s progressed. There were more houses to play. Mm-hmm. But to this day, one of the main problems for all independent filmmakers is there are a limited number of screens that will show a non-Hollywood movie, and there's only, you know, 52 weeks in the year.
Yeah.
There's only so many play dates, and there's a lot of movies being made.
Yep. But you have prevailed. You have survived and
survived. Prevailed, maybe not, but survived, yeah.
They are – maybe could be the same word.
Yeah. The because I remember when the film came out, mm-hmm. and I don't remember how I heard about it, how mm-hmm. I learned about it, but I was really taken by it, as were many, many people, mm-hmm. many of my friends. And so you sort of – you were far from an overnight success. Mm-hmm. You'd been writing – you know, I subsequently yeah. read your short book of short stories,
right.
The Anarchist Convention, and I became a fan.
Mm-hmm.
But this film definitely put you on the map. As a filmmaker.
Yeah, I always say I was catapulted from total obscurity to relative obscurity. and you know, I didn't get a studio deal. I got some better writing jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And the nice thing that's happened over the years is that my screenwriting career has been fueled by the movie making career, because I'll make something, you know, maybe with my own money or mm-hmm. for a very low budget, in a different genre than I've worked in before.
Mm-hmm.
And then the people who hire writers say, oh, he can write, you know, because at first, you know, I was just a horror movie writer.
Yeah.
You know, Joe Dante, after he made Piranha, the two movies he got offered were Swim Team and Jaws 3 People Nothing. You know, and Joe never wants to go near the water again or anything with scales on it. And you get pigeonholed very quickly,
yes.
and as a writer as well. But, you know, over the years, I've gotten to write in almost any genre, and partly because I've made movies in different genres.
Right. Well, I was touting you to one of my colleagues here at Earwolf earlier today, and the film that locked in for mm-hmm. her was The Secret of Roan Inish,
mm-hmm.
which she saw as a young person.
Yeah.
Her parents probably showed it to her. They
right.
brought her to the theater or showed it to her on video.
Yeah.
So that's not what one would call a typical John Sayles movie, but then there isn't a typical
there
John
isn't
Sayles
one.
Movie.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I've done science fiction and, you know, I have a bunch of movies that I've written that I haven't gotten to make that are even in other areas.
Mm-hmm.
And every once in a while, you're lucky enough to get one made.
Yeah.
But also the screenwriting job has been kind of good and informative for the filmmaking. You eventually get to work with a director
mm-hmm.
and you see how they work.
Mm-hmm.
Every once in a while, I get to do a day player role in something, and mm-hmm. you get on a set and you see, you know, other actors working and technicians working, and they're kind of auditioning for you without knowing it. You know, and I've often worked with those people later on.
Mm-hmm.
So I've been lucky in that way, in that I haven't been stuck just in one category as mm-hmm. he's just a writer or he's just a director or he's just an actor.
Mm-hmm. I was wondering, because you do have – your day player credits are kind of impressive. Because you're in Spike Lee's Malcolm X
mm-hmm.
as a goon.
Yeah. Yeah.
You're in
– Not typecasting.
You're in Jonathan Demme's
– Something Wild.
Something Wild.
Yeah.
And
the motorcycle cop.
You even worked for the great Bertrand Tavernier.
Yeah, that was really fun. In the Electric Mist.
Mm-hmm.
I think – very often, it's either Sam Shepard or John Malkovich have fallen through. So I get a call, you know. I got a call on one movie. I actually did this movie. It was a half-animated movie. And I just making a joke, I said, so what actor fell through? Because it was a last-minute call. And they said, Wally Shawn. And I said, oh, my God, I'm replacing Wally Shawn in movies now. But, yeah, you know, and you get that little window on the way they work.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Bertrand is somebody who his method of directing is to make a great messy, you know, mise-en-scène, you know, thing, and then kind of move the camera around through it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's not cut.
Mm-hmm.
And then other directors are very storyboarded and, you know, really mm-hmm. organized and everything mm-hmm. like that. And they're all legitimate ways to work.
Mm-hmm. I want to ask you about a couple of films. Eight Men Out,
mm-hmm.
which has, again, a wonderful cast, which is the story of the Black Sox scandal, the Chicago White Sox what would you call it? Lafayette White Sox. I don't know what.
Yeah, the scandal. The yeah. You know, they threw the World Series basically mm-hmm. for gamblers' money.
Mm-hmm. The way you shot baseball in that movie, the actual game, is so kinetic, so involving. You feel like, there are very few baseball films I can think of where you feel like you're on the field.
Yeah, we Robert Richardson, who shoots a lot of Oliver Stone's movies and has worked for Martin Scorsese and a bunch of other good directors, and I really talked about let's put you on the field because that's the conversation that the players are having. There was a strange thing that, like most conspiracies, it failed because they were a little ashamed of what they were doing and they didn't have enough meetings. They had two meetings and not the same guys weren't at both meetings. And all of a sudden people went, well, are we losing the whole series or just this game? And nobody had a definitive answer. And so the conversation is of, you know, a throw that almost takes your head off, like, what are you doing out here, you know? And then the players who aren't in on the fix are starting to realize what's going on. And they're sometimes with their chatter, but sometimes just with their body language are conversing as well. So we really felt like you have to put the audience in this game, whether they know it or not, and get a feel for the game, and then notice what happens when people aren't trying or when they're mad at each other or whatever. We also had the – this is before CGI. We had the problem of it's the World Series. The stands should be full. And we can't afford that many extras in period clothes. So every morning the question – the first question was how many extras showed up? And if it was less than 100, I'd look at Bob, you know, Richardson, and I'd say, okay, we're using the 100-millimeter lens today and we're not panning the camera. You know, and we only have one day where we actually could pan the camera or use like a 50 or a 35 and there were actually people there. Today, you just film, you know, you get 200 there one day and you'd film them doing stuff and you'd plug them in with CGI
later.
So problem solving is basically.
Yeah, there's the other thing that, that Bob came up with was, well, we're going to be shooting all day long and the sun's going to be moving around in you know, ways that aren't always going to go with our story. And he said, so what we'll do is we'll always backlight the people in the stands. So we actually moved around. We started shooting toward home plate from behind the pitcher. Then we, you know, we moved left over to first base. Then we went into right field, center field, toward third base. And at the end of the day, we were basically shooting into the dugouts because there wasn't any light left and we could light the dugouts. But, you know, given that, the stands are always backlit. So there's a consistency. It's not actually correct the way the light really would, but in the universe of the movie, which is what you're always creating, it makes sense to the viewer.
Wow. So much else to talk about. We'll do more of that talking in just a minute. Friends, today's sponsor is Casper Mattresses, obsessively engineered American-made mattresses at a shockingly fair price. And now you can get $50 toward any mattress purchase by going to casper.com/Malton and using the promo code Malton, which coincidentally is my last name, M-A-L-T-I-N. Listen, you spend about a third of your life sleeping, some of us more, some of us less. Let's make sure you're doing it on a good mattress. Casper brings together two comfy technologies for better nights and brighter days, latex foam and memory foam. So they've got just the right amount of sink, just the right bounce, no matter how you sleep. They've got a risk-free trial and return policy. Listen to this. They'll deliver it straight to you and you can try it for 100 days. I'm not kidding, 100 days. And if you're not happy, they'll pick it back up. At a store, you get a little time to try a mattress for a minute or two. With Casper, you'll actually get to sleep on it for up to 100 days, or rather, nights. It's $500 for a twin-size mattress, $950 for a king-sized. Comparing that to industry averages, it's an outstanding price point. So get $50 toward any mattress purchase by going to casper.com/Malton and using that promo code Malton, M-A-L-T-I-N. Terms and conditions apply. And we thank Casper for helping to sponsor Malton on Movies with Baron Vaughn.
Welcome back to Malton on Movies with Baron Vaughn. I'm Baron Vaughn. Over there is
Leonard Malton.
And we are here with our guest, John Sayles, talking about stuff and stuffing about talk. That doesn't make any sense, but I like to reverse things sometimes.
Matewan, a wonderful movie.
Thanks.
A heartfelt movie, obviously, about the labor movement and coal mining community. And who did you choose to shoot this? You shot with Haskell Wexler, who just left us a few weeks ago.
We got very lucky. We were driving down to West Virginia, and I was driving, and Maggie Renzi was reading a book called Masters of Light, which is about cinematographers. Mm-hmm. And she got to the Haskell chapter, and about halfway through it, because of the things that Haskell was saying, because he was interested in what the movies were about, mm-hmm. as well as how they looked. She said, we should work with this guy. And I had actually known his work and had talked to him once on the phone when he had a movie he needed to think about distribution with. And I'd liked him on the phone. And I said, well, let's get in touch with him. And so we, got to his people or whatever and left a message. And then the next day we got back to the Econolodge in Beckley, West Virginia. And the woman at the desk said, well, there's a fellow named Hacksaw Wexler who just called, and he was calling from his car. Haskell had all the gadgets in the world, and he had the first car phone, And he said, whatever those people want, the answer is yes. And so we got Haskell to come and shoot it. He wasn't so sure of it at first, because I was shooting in such small pieces, and it was hard for him to see how it was going to all cut together. But the thing that Haskell brought to it was that incredible experience that when we scouted, there are sequences where the eighth of a page shots that make a montage were shot over a 4-week period, sometimes in different counties. But they have to seamlessly come together in this 3.5-minute montage when the miners mark, they go on strike and they come out of the coal face and they march down the hill and they pass a little cabin and then they finally end up on the street. And Haskell would just look and say, okay, this eighth of a page, we should be shooting at between 2:30 and 3:30 in the day. He could just kind of look at the light where it was when we were scouting, and say, this is going to match, if this is the order that we're working in. And boy, when I got in the editing room and put it together with Sonia Polonsky, the editor, it was like, oh my God, it looks like a 3-minute sequence, that we shot in real time.
Boy.
Also, I think there was a great moment when the Italian coal miners who had been brought in as scabs to break the strike decide at the after a very tense confrontation to join the strike. And they march away. And it turns out that the coal company unknowingly has gotten a bunch of union activists from Milan who used to work in shoe factories who absolutely know what a sindacato, what a union is. And they march off singing Avanti Popolo, which is this old socialist Italian worker song. And Haskell turned to me and said, I think I'm the only cinematographer in Hollywood who knows the words to that song and what they mean.
Boy.
I did 4 movies with Haskell, which was – I think I held the record for the most movies any director did with him. And it was really a pleasure. He brought so much to it, just kind of in talking about the story, but also just that incredible for a low-budget filmmaker, speed-to-talent ratio. Haskell, we've only got 20 minutes. And it would look great with only 20 minutes of prep.
Man. He was passionate to the very end.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I saw him in his last year, and he had a bunch of projects. He made documentaries right to the end. He was complaining about politics right to the end.
How did you come to direct Bruce Springsteen videos?
We had used some of Bruce's music in Baby It's You. Mm-hmm. And to do that, we had gotten in touch with him and said, well, look, here's the screenplay. And if you let us use your music, what we would like to do is show you the movie with the music in it. And if you hate it, okay, fine, we don't use it. But if you think you like the movie and the use of the music, because he hadn't had his music in many movies.
This is in the early 80s. We should
the early 80s, yeah.
The
and then John Landau, his manager, ended up saying, well, we really like the movie. And You know, here's the deal. Bruce owns half the rights to these, and I think it was CBS Records. Mm-hmm. You know, we can't do anything about CBS Records, but we're not going to charge you hardly anything. So we actually got a break on these four songs. Mm-hmm. So I had known people in his camp, you know, the mm-hmm. people around him, and then we got a call, and Bruce had done one video at that point, Dancing in the Dark, mm-hmm. and they wanted to do something where, you know, well, maybe it was a little grittier and maybe one where he played a character in it or whatever. And I was able to say, well, I do gritty. and so we did Born in the USA, I'm on Fire, which we shot out here in Los Angeles, and then Glory Days, which we shot in Hoboken. And Bruce was great. He's the boss for a reason. You know, he really, you know, he had ideas about what should be in the video that were really good ideas. The people around him were fun to work with because I'd been hearing horror stories from my other friends who worked on rock videos about, mm-hmm. you know, the record label, this and, you mm-hmm. know, the crazy musicians that. So it was really a nice job. We had much more money to shoot 3 minutes and a half than we ever had to shoot any other 3 minutes and a half, even though they weren't profligate. You know, they were reasonably budgeted. And then I got to edit them, and I got to cut to Bruce Springsteen music. And how much fun is that with a lot of footage? Yeah. So,
just a couple of Jersey Boys.
Yeah. we were scouting in for Born in the USA, and we had gone past one of those authorized personnel only signs to look at a building that was about to be blown up and, you know, made into rubble and cleared away to build something else. And while we were looking at it, a police car pulls up behind us and the officer gets out and, what are you doing here? And well, we said, we're scouting for a video. And he said, yeah, well, you're not supposed to be in here. And we said, well, it's a Bruce Springsteen video. And he said, put it in gear. And then he talked to us for a half an hour about the first time he saw Bruce. And everything. So it's a great name to drop in New Jersey.
Yes, it sure is. Almost anywhere, but especially in New Jersey.
Yeah.
Yeah. Tell us about how you work with actors. Now, you were an actor yourself. Mm-hmm. You continue to act sometimes in your own movies.
Currently
often
are
movies.
An actor, yes.
Yeah. And well, we talked about Passion Fish, for instance, on this show, which is such a not only a really good film, but such a wonderful showcase for Alfre Woodard and for Mary MacDonald. Obviously, they're intelligent actors. They read your words. They understood the characters. But how do you help them on a day-to-day basis, or what kind of conversations do you have to prepare them for the
film? Know, there's a certain kind of handicapping that you do because you have to learn very quickly, how do you help this particular actor? Because all actors have their own way into a part, and some of them are more cerebral, and some of them are more visceral, and some of them don't really want to learn their lines until the last minute or maybe after the last minute. one thing that I do for all my characters in my movies from the first movie is I write a bio. A biography of the character. And if it's a big character, it might be 3 or 4 pages. If it's a small one, it might be a half page. You might have a longer bio than your part is. But it's the stuff that if I had to play that part, I might want to know about the character that's not necessarily obvious in the script. And so I give that bio to the actors and I say, well, if we're close to each other, we can meet in person, or we can call me up if you have any questions or problems about it. So we work some of the stuff that you ordinarily would do on the set out beforehand, just about who that person is. In the case of Passion Fish, Mary's way of working was very, very different than Alfre's. Mary's somebody who doesn't want to hear the whole note. You know, you'd say, well, this time, could you be a little bit more? I got it, you know. And she would. She would have it. You know, she would get that little bit of a hint, but she didn't want it totally articulated. Alfre came from a movie that she had been shooting until 10 o'clock the night before came on the set. And she said, look, you know, I loved the script when I read it. It's just going to be great, but I'm way behind here. And so if you want to give me a line reading or anything like that, go ahead and do it. You know, just tell me what you want, you know, very specifically, and I'll make it mine. So you have, you know, so you're handicapping already because you're working differently with the two actresses. And so many of the scenes in Passion Fish are these kind of little battles. These little wrestling for control, you know. The power dynamic is that, you know, one has power because she's the rich lady and she's, you know, she writes the checks. and this other person is her employee. And Alfrey's character has power because she can use both her legs, mm-hmm. you know. And at one point, she gets mad at her employer and strands her out in a field in a wheelchair, you know. And it's like, okay, if you're going to be that way, you know, get yourself out of this one. So there's that kind of tension and push and pull between them. So a lot of what I would do, I always use the allegory of if you were the corner man for both the fighters and just want to see a really good fight. Mm-hmm. So you take the person aside and say, you know, don't let her do that to you. You know, we're not going to change any lines here, but, you know, she's pushing you around. And I need this moment where you just you don't say no, but you just aren't buying it anymore. And then you'll go to the other one and say, you know, see if you can get her to cry, you know, or whatever it is. It's not a mm-hmm. trick, yeah. but it's changing the dynamic mm-hmm. each time. And then good actors hook into each other and something different happens with the same lines. You know, we got to work with Roger Deakins, the cinematographer, mm-hmm. on that, you know, and that was great too. You know, just Roger using, you know, at that time, mostly natural light and bouncing light and stuff like that and not taking very much time. So, you know, in between setups, you know, of different angles, there wasn't really that much time. So the actors were able to kind of hook into each other and stay into each other mm-hmm. for the whole scene. Mm-hmm. And it might be the whole morning that they were in that kind of thing. I don't call them non-actors because we often cast people from the place or we cast mm-hmm. kids who aren't professional actors. I call them new actors. Mm-hmm. I might work a little bit differently. And the big difference is I usually tell them don't learn the lines right away. You know, especially kids think the job is to learn the lines. And so they learn the lines and they learn everybody else's lines. And then you can kind of see them, 1, 2, 3, 4, my line, mm-hmm. you know. Mm-hmm. And so they're not really listening. And so I start slower with them and I often say, okay, you know, read the script. What's the story about? And we'll talk about it. Then I say, so who's your character? And I get them to really do the work that a professional actor would do. But they're not quite sure, you know, it's not like they're being left back in school or anything. They just think, oh, this is the way movies get made. You get to talk about the character before and think about who you are. And then eventually I'll say, well, what's the scene about? What happens in this scene? And a couple times with kids, I've said, well, you know, that this adult actor who's working with you, they're really old and they may not say the lines in the same order. So you're going to have to be on your toes and you're going to have to, as your character, whatever they give you, you have to respond to that. Hmm. You can't say, oh, we've got to stop here. We're out of order. And, you know, sometimes I'll actually have the adult actor, you know, if they're kind of the cameras behind them do that just to, you know, but the kids are really, oh, wow. You mean I really have to know who I am and what's going on in the scene and eventually my lines. So it's a little bit longer with new actors than with professionals. A lot of what you do as a director with professionals is you talk about the character, you give them the bio, and I don't do read-throughs or rehearsals. You know, we may do a blocking rehearsal, which is always no acting, please, you know, thing. And then you just – for the first couple of takes, you see what are they going to do? Hmm. And it may be very different than what you thought and better in some cases. And then you say keep going in that direction. Or if it's kind of wandering away from you, then you direct. You know, and that's what a director does is you direct other people's talents. You don't teach people how to act and you don't tell them what to do. You push them in this direction and that direction. And truly on a low budget movie, the main job of the director is an acting job, which is to get the actors to think that there's absolutely no time pressure. When there absolutely is, mm-hmm. you know, and so that they feel like, well, I could do it. You know, there's another way I want to try it. You say, yeah. You know, even though everybody else says, oh, God, the sun's going down. Why are you doing another take? You know, I thought we had that in the can. You want the actor to have that shot and leave the set and come in the next day feeling like they've had their day in court.
Sometimes you get pleasant surprises.
Yeah. I mean, I on our movie Amigo, I wrote a character who was the leader of a guerrilla band, you know, during the Philippine-American War. And Ronnie Lazaro, who was playing him, read my little biography. And historically, a lot of the first of the people who started the revolt against the Spanish in the Philippines around, you know, 1900 were guys who were Jesuits. They were seminary students. And then the church just said, Filipinos can't be priests. And that radicalized these guys. They said, wait a minute, you know, God doesn't care, you know, what your race is or what your color is. You know, we're talking about God here. You know, we're not talking about you prejudiced humans. And that radicalized them. And so I said, you know, this guy was a former seminary student. Da, da, da. Well, one of the first scenes we shot was a battle scene. And I realized, oh, my God, he's playing it like a guy who is really a liability in a firefight. You know, he can barely get the bullets into the gun and he's shaking. You know, and he's playing it like a seminary student. Hmm. And I started thinking, is this going to work? It's interesting, but is it going to work? And then on one side of him was an actor named Bembo Rocco. If you ever saw Year of Living Dangerously, he has a huge part in that wonderful old actor. And then on the other side is another actor who was playing like a half Chinese psycho killer. And I said, oh, he's got that taken care of. He's got two warriors next to him. He's the brains of the outfit. Hmm. But when he gets into a firefight, he's a seminary student. Hmm. And it was just so interesting. And I had not thought of it, taking it that far. And at the end of it, he kind of looked at me and I say, yep, I think that's where we're going to go with this character. So those are really nice surprises. Every once in a while, somebody tries something and you just have to say, you know, yeah, I don't think that's going to take us where we need to go. Mm-hmm. And why don't you, you know, give me some more of these things. I had Marcia Gay Harden in this movie that we made in Mexico, Casa de los Babies. Mm-hmm. And she was playing a woman who was, you know, with a bunch of other women who were about to adopt babies. And gradually it's revealed that she's a sociopath. She should not be allowed in a room with a child, much less be given one to, mm-hmm. you know, to mother. And she came to me before we started and she said, you know, there's so many ways to play these scenes. And I said, and I want to see them all. Hmm. And so, you know, she actually ended up getting a few more takes than anybody else because being the actress that she is, she would just do incredible things, not change a line, but sometimes it would be a little hint that she was a little off. Sometimes she would be covering up perfectly. And other times it was, oh, my God, get me out of the room. This person's going to, you know, grab a gun and shoot us all. The great thing about that is when I went into the editing room, I had that range and I could say, how do I want to reveal to the audience and to the other characters that she's crazy? You know, what's that, you know, that arc? And she just gave me all this ammunition. And that's great when you get an actor who feels, you know, who trusts the script, trusts the director enough that they'll try stuff that may just be crazy, but it also might be great.
Wow. So much to talk about. We'll have more talk in just a moment.
Hey, guys, this is Baron Vaughn of Malton on Movies with Baron Vaughn. I want to talk to you about Iotic, featuring the best in original short form content, presents I Killed Susan Blake, a four-part noir miniseries, one like you've never seen before. The husband, the best friend, the sister, the gardener, the lover. They all had a reason to kill Susan Blake, who didn't, when they all confessed to Susan's murder. It is up to a grizzled detective to expose the shocking truth before one of them gets away with the ultimate crime. Hour by hour, their stories unfold, lies come to light, and the shocking truth behind Susan Blake's murder comes to a startling conclusion that you will never forget. I Killed Susan Blake. They know who killed her. Do you? Check out I Killed Susan Blake online at iotic.tv. That's iotic.tv. That's AIOTK.tv. Watch the first part for free and then get 11% discount off your Iotic subscription when you sign up for a year. You'll get exclusive access to everything on Iotic.tv, including I Killed Susan Blake and the hit series Dudes. Iotic.tv, today's voices, today's stories.
Welcome back to Malton on Movies with Baron Vaughn. We are here in the company, in the august presence of John Sayles, and very happy to be. And we're recording this on the verge of a John Sayles retrospective, which will have already come and gone by the time you hear this, I'm sorry to say, but maybe there'll be others. Yeah. The Cine Family here in Los Angeles is doing this as a kickoff of a tribute to indie filmmakers of the 80s, I think. But you're not isolated in the 80s. In fact, you're a guy who's always looking ahead to the next project. Do you have another project in the works?
Yeah, right now I always have three or four movies written that, you know, are, you know – freeze-dried movies, just add money, you know. Eight Men Out took 11 years from when I wrote the first draft until we got to make it. So I always say I started with Martin Sheen at third base and ended up with Charlie Sheen in center field. the thing that we're trying to raise money for right now is called To Save the Man. It's set at the Carlisle Indian Industrial School in 1890. And the Carlisle School was eventually – it got known because Jim Thorpe went there and was a great football player there. It was the template. It was the first of the Native American boarding schools run by a guy, Richard Henry Pratt, who'd been a military man, had commanded black troops and had Indian scouts and came out of that experience after the Civil War and the early Indian wars after the Civil War saying, whoa, these people are – you know, morally and intellectually totally equal with us. What's holding them back is their culture. Well, blacks are now no longer enslaved, and they speak English, so they've got a chance. But these native people who don't speak any English and their culture is so alien to what seems to be going on in the United States, they don't have a chance. And they were down to 250,000 Native Americans, the lowest the population has ever gotten from disease and war and this and that. And so he was a progressive of his time, not just a liberal of his time, because most other people were saying, well, they're on their way out. Let's just kill the rest of them or let them die off from tuberculosis or whatever crammed onto these reservations where we've pushed them. And he got permission from the Army to start this school in Carlisle, Pennsylvania, former Army barracks. And his catchphrase, though, was, to save the man, we must kill the Indian. So this is kind of like, you know, Dead Poets Society. So it is a teenage movie. You know, it's a boarding school movie, boys and girls in uniforms trying to work it out together. But it's also a movie about very conscious cultural genocide. We're going to treat these kids like they're immigrants, and just like Italian kids coming in and Polish kids coming in, you've got to forget that, and you've got to learn English and forget that culture and become an American.
Assimilate.
Yeah. So here's this guy telling Native Americans that they have to become Americans, you know. And it was the Harvard and the Alcatraz of Native Americans. Kids went through, got law degrees. Among the people who got law degrees were people who eventually got Native Americans citizen status in 1924. Before that, they were wards of the state. So if you ran away from the Carlisle School, you were a federal fugitive, not just a kid who ran away from boarding school. But also people committed suicide, got diseases, were, you know, really kind of horrified by what happened to themselves there. And depending on what tribe you came and how long they'd been kind of working with the white world and, you know, how long they'd been speaking English, you were more or less a fish out of water or somebody where, oh, this is a great opportunity. So a really complex story, and the Carlisle School was the template for all the other Native American schools. Not as bad as many of them became of various kinds of abuse of the kids, but you know, right in the founding of it, right in the philosophy of the guy who founded the school was this idea of to save the man, we must kill the Indian.
Wow.
So not something the studios are going to make tomorrow.
but if that Powerball ticket comes in.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You know, it's, we often have fantasies of going to Las Vegas and just getting lucky or something like that, or, you know, the world's best bake sale. And our movies, you know, as the independent movie world, if there is such a thing, is even more volatile than the studio world. So every time out, if it's a year and a half or 2 years or even 5 years sometimes, the way that movies get financed is very different. And the way that movies get distributed is very different. That, you know, most of the movies that they're showing at this retrospective, the companies that distributed them don't exist anymore and haven't for years and years and years.
Yeah, that was a question I wanted to ask because it is an esoteric term, I guess, to say independent film or an independent filmmaker. But it seems to me the commonality is that everyone gets to define what that means for themselves.
Yeah, I mean, for me, the most important definition is an independence of spirit, which is you start out, this is the story you want to make, and somehow you get it made. And you don't, you know, there was that phrase during the Vietnam War, we had to destroy the village in order to save it. You don't destroy your movie in order to make it. And, you know, so I think of the Coen brothers, even though they work within the studio system very often, they're independent filmmakers. There's other people who manage that and sometimes get to work with studios and use their money, and sometimes the movies are very successful. Most people, however, independent means, oh, so we're not going to get paid much if we work for you. You know, that's really what it means.
Right, right.
Is you're not going to have quite enough to comfortably shoot the movie. I usually have almost enough. Sometimes only once did we have more than enough. We made a movie called Limbo up in Alaska for Sony Pictures. And at the end of the day, we had $1 million that we hadn't used. they said,
wow.
Right, send it back right away. And it was just that the weather was better than we thought it had. And we had budgeted wisely for a lot of rain days that just didn't. You know, because it's Pacific rainforest up there.
Right.
And they just, you know, we got a break. But usually, you know, it's that thing of, you know, having started, you know, being a writer for Roger Corman movies and seeing, well, that's all just kind of, there's very little that's, you know, capital intensive. It's mostly people with good ideas and really knowing what you're doing and what you're going for and working hard and being enthusiastic because you're young. Mm-hmm. And, you know, most of our movies, that's kind of what we count on, at least for the actors. Sometimes the crew are not so thrilled about it. But at least for the actors, it's, oh, wow, I'm getting to play a part I never would get to play in any other movie. Mm-hmm. And it's about real people, you know, and there's mm-hmm. not a blue screen or a green screen behind me. Mm-hmm. And I'm not pretending that tennis ball is a monster that's about to eat me.
Right.
Wow, I get to act with another human being.
One of the things we like to ask our guests is if there is a film that they particularly like or recommend that is either underrated,
unsung.
Yeah, I think, too, that people don't see often enough. Smile, which is a mm-hmm. Michael Ritchie movie from, I think, 75. Mm-hmm. Just a terrific, you know, he really kind of understood America. You know, he made the original Bad News Bears, which mm-hmm. is a very good movie as well. He did the Downhill Racer. Mm-hmm. I think he did a couple movies, The Candidate with Robert yep. Redford. And Smile is just – it's a, you know, a big canvas. It's during – it's very funny. It's during you know, kind of Miss Junior America pageant in this little town. And Bruce Dern plays this guy who's got, you know, he's trying to run the whole thing. And Barbara Feldon's his wife, and she's going in a different direction. And you meet a whole community, including mm-hmm. the kids who are in the pageant and the kids who are peeping at the girls through the windows while mm-hmm. the pageant is happening. Just a great kind of messy American movie that has a lot of class stuff in it and mm-hmm. stuff about, you know, when the American dream doesn't, you know, it doesn't really work. And the other one that, you know,
Bruce Dern is very fond of that movie.
Yeah, oh, it's one of his best performances. Yeah. It's mm-hmm. really, really wonderful performance in it. And then the other one is Melvin and Howard, Jonathan Demme's
yes.
movies. Which was Paul LaMatt and Mary Steenburgen, who I've gotten to work with a bunch of times, mm-hmm. is in it when she was very young. And Jason Robards plays Howard Hughes in it. Mm-hmm. And once again, it's just such an – you know, you couldn't make it in another country. It's such an American movie. Mm-hmm. And it, once again, it's about that American dream. And what exactly is that? And when is it a good thing? And when is it kind of going to get you in trouble? Mm-hmm. And you know, it has this iconic figure of Howard Hughes – who, well, was that the American dream, to get that rich? And he's one of the most unhappy people, mm-hmm. you know, that you could ever meet, until he runs into this guy who's like a gas station operator, you know, out in the desert, and they actually have some fun together. And he hasn't had fun in years, you know, and where did his dream take him? And Jonathan's so good with music and with character and mm-hmm. this, you know, it's not your usual plot-driven,
yeah.
you know, thing, but you would come away from it and say, look at those incredible people I met. And that's, you know, both of these movies are really fun, and they make you think at the end of them. They're not like a meal that you say, what did we just eat?
Yeah. No, I was a great fan of Melvin and Howard, and you're reminding me that it's time to revisit.
Yeah.
If it's available, we're going to do that.
Let us do that.
Let us do that indeed. I think Mary Steenburgen was waitressing at the time she got that role.
Oh, really?
I think I remember reading a funny story, an interview with her, where she said, I'm not showing up Saturday. I'm going to be in a movie. I hope I'm not telling that wrong or misattributing the story.
Yeah, yeah.
I think it's around that time, yes.
No, I had to my last movie that I made out here, Gopher Sisters. I was working with an actor who had been in Lone Star years ago, Mexican-American actor. And just over the years, he wasn't getting that much work. And he felt like, oh, I want to do something a little more. And he started working for one of the city councilmen out here. And we had scheduled him to, you know, he said, okay, yeah, I'll come out of retirement and do this little part. It was a one-night thing. And then he called and he said, oh, can you move the night? Because they're having a city council meeting about legalizing marijuana. And my councilman says, well, you know more about that than I do. So could you represent me there? You know, and I said, okay, I can bump it one night. So, you know, it goes both ways. You know, there are people who are actors for a long time and then they actually find something else that they really get excited about doing.
Yeah.
And occasionally you can, you know, and occasionally they do that for a while and then they get discovered again. Just kind of somebody calls them in.
Yeah, exactly. John, it's such a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you.
And to have you here. And we'll be talking about more of your movies.
Great.
And plugging them, flogging them away.
Flogging them. They need flogging.
And maybe, who knows, maybe there's somebody with deep pockets listening right now who is intrigued by that story because you told the story very well.
Yeah.
You got us hooked. And you know, send to John Sayles, Hollywood, USA. Just send the check like that. Yeah. I'm sure it will reach him with no trouble at all.
Make it out to cash.
Yeah. Thanks so much again.
Thank you. Thanks.
And,
great to be here.
Baron, between now and the next episode, if someone wants to reach you.
Oh, you can reach me on the internet. Google me. Type my name into Google. That's my website. What about you, Leonard?
I'm not so easy to find, but I'm at leonardmalton.com is my website, and Twitter is at Leonard Maltin. And friends, thanks again for listening, for supporting the show. Tell your friends. Tell crowds of people.
Tell your enemies even.
We're not fussy. We just want ears. We want ears listening.
But don't send them in.
No. Keep them to yourself. Thanks again. Talk to you next time. Bye-bye. Today's episode was sponsored by the good folks at Aiotic. Aiotic brings you the best in original short-form content from today's voices telling today's stories. Be sure to check out I Killed Susan Blake, exclusively on Aiotic TV. Don't forget to sign up today for 11% off your first year's subscription. You find them on the web at aiotk.tv. I'll say it one more time, aiotk.tv. That's Aiotic.
This is Stephen Dubner from Question of the Day, where every week James Altucher and I attempt to answer your questions. And all this week, our very special guest questioner is Brian Koppelman. Brian is one of the creators of the hit show Billions and way more. We talk time management, Uber drivers, and of course, what it is like to help create a hit show.
They pay me a squillion dollars. I just want to give it to you straight. It's a squillion off the
we
top.
We also knew that was
that's true. Like with podcasts.
Yeah.
Usually about three quarters of a squillion. Subscribe to Question of the Day on iTunes, and you can listen on earwolf.com or via your favorite podcasting app.
This has been an Earwolf production, executive produced by Scott Aukerman, Adam Sachs, and Chris Bannon. For more information and content, visit earwolf.com.